You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio 96.5 FM, also streaming live at WSLR.org. My name is Emily, and my guest today is Dr. David Jacobs. Dr. Jacobs is an associate professor of history at Temple University in Philadelphia and has also been a UFO researcher for over 40 years. Dr. Jacobs is the director of ICAR, the International Center for Abduction Research. So, Dr. Jacobs, thanks very much for talking to me today.
Well, thanks for having me, Emily.
To start off with, could you tell us a little history about yourself and how you became involved and interested in UFO research?
Well, that's one of the harder questions that I have to answer, actually. I got interested in the subject when I was an undergraduate at UCLA back in the mid-1960s. And I began to read it for sort of recreational purposes, just relaxation and so forth, as a history major. And the more I read in the subject of UFOs, of course we didn't know much about abductions in those days, the more interested I got in it, and then I began to realize that there might be a signal in the noise here that this was something that might be very important. And by 1966, when I moved to the University of Wisconsin to do graduate work in history, I sort of determined that I wanted to do research in this area and read every single word ever written about UFOs, which in 1966 was actually a feasible thing to do.
Why? And, because there really wasn't much information out there?
Right, exactly. Now it's impossible. It's just impossible. I mean, because there's so many different ways of publishing books, including just by yourself, that it's just not possible for anybody to do it, it seems to me.
And absolutely. And with the Internet, there's just a minefield of information out there.
It is a minefield, and I realized after a while that virtually everything I'd read in the first year of my readings about UFOs was wrong. But I wound up eventually asking the question, why is it that the subject has had so much study of it within the Air Force and the government and so forth, and yet we don't know a whole heck of a lot about it? And so I wrote my doctoral dissertation in the field of intellectual history on the controversy over unidentified flying objects in America between 1896 and 1973. That then was published as a book called The UFO Controversy in America by Indiana University Press. And I just sort of stuck with the subject ever since then. And by 1982, I got interested in the abduction phenomenon through my friend Bud Hopkins, who sort of showed me what he was doing and how he was doing things. And I was very impressed by him and by his methodology. And it wasn't until 1986, however, that I decided to do my own research in the field of abductions. And I did my first hypnosis with an abductee in August of 86. Since that time, I've worked with a small number of people, about 150, but I worked for long periods of time with them. And so I have researched about 1,100 abduction events individually. And, of course, I've talked with and interviewed thousands of other people over the years who've had their own experiences and so forth. But those are all kind of uncontrollable situations. In other words, I can't control the flow of information or the questions are all that, or all of that. So, now it's not as smooth as I'm saying. I was, in fact, a fairly strong skeptic about the abduction phenomenon when I was in UFO sightings world. And to me, it was just strictly a psychological. There were some puzzling aspects of it, but it was really psychological. And I had no use for it. All I knew is it just made UFO researchers look stupid because people were saying that they were abducted into UFOs, and of course that was just crazy. And so I didn't pay any attention to it. I didn't read up on it. When I first met Bud Hopkins, I had not even bothered to read his book, which was Missing Time, which came out in 81. And even at a conference that I went to in 1981 with him, rather than listen to his paper, one of the first papers presented on abductions, I just figured that would be a waste of time. And I stood out in the hall and joked with a friend of mine, Marcello Truzzi, who taught at Eastern Michigan University at the And I thought I had a much more productive time standing in the hall than sitting in the room and listening to Bud talk about abductions, because that was just a waste of my energy, my time. Everybody knew that abduction was just a nonsense. So I had to go through a learning curve in order to get to the point where I realized this is something important. And it didn't take me long once I started reading it seriously, but it wasn't a smooth transition, in other words.
So what was it that finally convinced you that there was some truth to the whole abduction thing?
Well, Hopkins invited me up to his New York apartment. I'm here in Philadelphia. And I met some abductees. I was able to sit in on sessions that he was having with abductees. And these were sincere, intelligent people who obviously did not have some sort of serious brain disorder, which meant that they could not tell fantasy from reality. And if that was the case, one would assume that something like that would show up in a lot of different areas of their life. And these were mainly normally or high-functioning people. And so everything that I thought should be true turned out not to be true. And I believe that ultimately that Hopkins was on to something. But the only way to tell for sure was to just do it myself. So that sort of ultimately, now it took me 4 years to get to that point after meeting Bud and talking with him. So it was a slow transition. There wasn't any eureka moment or anything like that, or some sudden transformation. I guess I'm just a slow learner. Maybe that's what the problem is.
Now, you've actually done hypnotherapy on hundreds of people who've
I've worked with about 150 people, but it's not just that I have a session with them. I try to have as many sessions as possible. So I've had, one session with people. People come once, and that's it for them. They don't want to come back again. Maybe the chemistry isn't right. Maybe they don't like my deodorant. Who knows what they don't like. But that's it. They leave. Other people have stayed with me for as long as 20 years and longer so that I can see change over time in terms of the abduction phenomenon, what is happening with them over time. And I've worked with people... As the phrase goes, from all walks of life, it's good, the bad, the ugly. It's anybody and everybody. It's people who are internationally known scientists. Well, I should say I've talked to those. I work with people who are, in fact, scientists. I've worked with people who are university professors, who are psychiatrists, psychologists, people who are high school teachers, people who are therapists, people who dropped out of school in the sixth grade. People could never get it together, never hold a job, and everybody in between, and they all say the same thing. And I've been fortunate enough to work with a significant number of them for long periods of time, and so that I get to know them as well. I know that they're not crazy, they're not trying to pull a wool over my eyes and all that sort of thing. And I've been very fortunate. I think I'm the only person in the world who's been able to do that. So my take on the subject is can be a lot more in-depth on an individual level for each person than a lot of other researchers.
Now, when you say that they all say the same thing to you, what is the basic reports that you get from people, like from the beginning of how they experienced the abduction initially and what they actually put through?
Right. Well, basically, these are people who have no particular, vision of what life should be like, and they're not necessarily heavily spiritual people, although some of them are, of course. They're not involved with the New Age, although a few of them were. They're not people who are necessarily who do channeling. In other words, they're not necessarily involved in sort of the more fringes of learning about the world as others are. They're just normal people. But they all say the same thing. And what they say basically is they're taken out of their normal environment. The normal environment might be their bed, might be their car, might be their living room, might be their backyard, might be anywhere, except in their work area. And even then, sometimes they're taken out of their workplace. They are taken on board an object, a UFO, Their clothes are removed, they're taken into a room, they're placed on a table, they're given a physical examination, they're removed from the table, they go into other rooms. So this happens to them, that happens to them. There's a series of reproductive and physical experiences that they are subjected to. I'm simplifying this enormously, of course. They're then taken back to their normal environment, their clothes put on, they're taken back, and all they know is that they were driving on this road, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, or it's 10 o'clock in the morning, for that matter, and they're driving along, and it's suddenly 12 o'clock in the morning, 2 hours later, and they're still driving on the road, and they're still sort of in the same place. In other words, they've had a lapse of time without a displacement of place, of location, and it's just they can't get their brains around what just happened. I mean, did I fall into some sort of a faint, or did I lose consciousness? And if that happened, why am I still driving, and how come the car didn't go off the road and crash against a tree or something? And if I was in a fog, how come I'm not any further down the road? In other words, nothing makes sense.
The problem
here is that it happens with two or three people in the same car. None of whom know what just happened.
But if that kind of thing is happening in broad daylight, not just when someone's in bed sleeping, is it only in isolated areas, or how come people aren't seeing, you know, flying saucer come down?
Yeah, it can be in isolated areas. It depends on where they are and what's happening. In other words, if they're on Highway 95, which runs on the Eastern Corridor here, or on a freeway in Los Angeles or wherever it is, the chances of it happening are much less. If they are in an isolated area, the chances of it happening can be increased. In other words, they're going to be taken when they're missed the least. And they're going to be taken when, because this is a clandestine operation, when people will not be viewing it, although it's more complicated than that. However, in the cases that I just told you, described to you, most of these were taken, most of these cases happen in not real well-traveled, not expressways or turnpikes or something like that, but in just regular roads where this happens. And sometimes it happens at night when there's not that much traffic. And it doesn't happen in the way you think it would happen. In other words, for years people told us, you know, the wife and I, we were traveling along and we saw a UFO. And it was just amazing. It was just unbelievable. I mean, it was on the left side of the road, then it went to the right side of the road, and both of us, we're looking at it, and it was just amazing. You know, I pulled over to the side of the road, and we turned down those windows to get a better look at that thing, and it was just hovering off the ground, and maybe it was 100 yards from us. We just couldn't amaze it. We just couldn't imagine it. And then suddenly that object, it just got up and flew off at tremendous speed, and then we just continued down the road. It was amazing. Now, we heard, I cannot tell you how many of these stories for years and years and years, the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and now whatever, until I began to look into them, because it always seemed to me just slightly off kilter. Even though it seemed logical, to me it just seemed slightly off that they would pull over to the side of the road to get a better look.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a pretty good look driving just as well, you know what I mean? It's not like you're going to get a closer look necessarily or anything. So it depends on the situation, but I began to look at these cases, and invariably what they were telling me was, we saw this UFO, it was just amazing, it was just incredible, it was on the left-hand side of the street, it went over the right-hand side of the street, and that thing was hovering 100 yards away, boy, and then we pulled over to the side of the road and stopped the car, and we waited, and then people came over and they opened the door. And we got out of the car and we went over to this object and then we were lifted up into it. Then they did this to us and that to us and this to us and that to us and this and that and this and that. Then we came out of the object and we went back into the car and we sat on. And you know, that UFO, it just lifted up and it flew away at tremendous speed. And we just continued driving on then. That's what was happening. And then I began to realize this is a far more hidden phenomenon than we thought. And the pulling off to the side of the road became a red flag when I began to look at these sightings. So it happens sort of like that. It's obviously easier at night, a lot of these do happen at night, of course, and a lot of them happen during the daytime and so forth. But the key thing is that people don't know what happened to them. Suddenly they might realize as they're going down the road, wait a second, it's 3 hours later, you know. How can that be possible?
I know that for however long people have been seeing, or, you know, with even cave drawings of UFO-type objects.
We can date the UFO phenomenon with a fair degree of certainty to probably latter half of the 19th century. After that, evidence for it drops off drastically, to say the least. Really drastically. And then you get, you know, cave paintings and you get other kinds of paintings and people say, look, it's round. Therefore, it is a UFO. And this kind of ancient astronaut stuff never made it into serious UFO research. It never made it into the serious UFO research community. It always remained within the realm of popular culture. Only one person, Jacques Vallée, ever took any credence in it. Then he tried to link UFO sightings with elves and trolls and gnomes and things and fairy tales and folklore and all the rest of that stuff, and the problem was that Jacques is not a folklorist. When we've had professional folklorists look at this stuff, it doesn't fit anything that we know of in the UFO phenomenon.
So why do you think it's suddenly started?
Well, when you ask a why question like that. Then you get into the intricacies of how do we know these things. Now, for example, with UFOs, what you're looking at is the outside shells of objects. It is impossible to tell what the motivation of the outside shells of objects are unless you sort of personalize them. In fact, UFO researchers in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s did a tremendous amount of sort of personalization or anthropomorphism, I should say, of UFOs. In other words, the UFO did this, the UFO did that, and there's UFO behavior, and it's as if the UFO had a mind of its own. If you were to suggest that there were people inside the UFO who, in fact, were dictating where it was doing, what it was doing, where it was going, that was a line over which a lot of UFO researchers would not walk, because that suggested aliens, and they wanted to keep it as unidentified flying objects and just make it sort of neutral so it was more acceptable to the scientific community and all that. The problem was that what they called occupants were seen sometimes by the object or near the object if it was on the ground. The occupants, that nobody would say the word alien because that was too crazy, occupant behavior was extremely bizarre and almost impossible to divine. And by the 1960s, we had a large number of occupant cases. As by 1973, there was a book written about them, and they sort of became important. But it was divining ultimately the goals, motivations, and purposes of UFOs, or should I say the people inside them, that began to occupy abduction researchers' attention. And we know that that abductions and the UFO phenomenon had to start at a certain time. Now, the question is, how can we have some sort of reasonable a way of dating the phenomenon without having to resort to, look at that rock, somebody drew a picture of something round on it, you know what I mean? There's got to be a better way to do that. And one of the ways, now we launch ourselves into the abduction phenomenon, what Bud Hopkins found in the early 80s and what I confirmed a little bit later and what we both found was that there were certain tenets of the abduction phenomenon that were seen to be inviolable. That is to say, they happened intergenerally. Let me see that. They happen intergenerationally in that a person would be an abductee if their mother or their father or both of them were abductees, and that if they have children, generally speaking, all the children will be abductees, even if they have children with a non-abductee.
Now, couldn't that just be people passing stories down and then the children sort of embellishing it in their minds?
Well, I wish that were true. I hope that's true. I hope you're right. And yes, I guess it could be. It doesn't seem to be. It seems to be in every case that we have looked at. See what I mean? In other words, we haven't found any exceptions to this yet in years and years and years of doing this work. So it seems to you that this is a real event that we're looking at. And every abductee I talk to says, well, you know, my mother used to talk about my mother had an apparition. Whatever it was, there were odd things happening to her mother or her father or both the parents. And then they'll talk eventually about their odd things happening to the children as well and so forth. And of course, we know that they were abducted when they were children because they remember being abducted with their parents. And when we do sessions with parents, they remember being abducted with their children. And so we know that there's an intergenerational link that is simply part of it. We just don't find a significant number of people where there's not an intergenerational link. That's the one thing. The second thing is that it happens at great frequency. It starts in infancy and it goes into old age. Well, okay, if you have those things, particularly the intergenerational link and all the children will be abductees, and this is something that we see constantly, and we have been able to test this actually with children who were adopted, who are not abductees, and yet their adopted brother, who is a biological child of the family, is an abductee, along with the mother or the father, and as an adopted child, they're not abductees. They're not in the lineage. You see what I mean? Even though they're living in the family. But, if that's the case, what you're going to have through population growth is a cone-like spreading out in the society because abductees will marry non-abductees because they don't even know they're abductees. Neither of them do. And so you get a cone-like spreading out in the society from small to large over the generations. That leads you ultimately to the question, well, if that's the case, how long will it take for everybody in the whole damn country to be an abductee, let's just say, as opposed to the whole world?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had a mathematician work this out for me once, depending, of course, on how many people you started with. But it sort of develops exponentially if you have more than a 2.0 ratio of children to parents. In other words, the parents just reproduce themselves and that's all. It won't be that way, but they don't do that. They get married to other people. They have blended families, and you do have a population growth. So it turns out if you start with 100,000 people, it's X number of generations. If you start with 1 million people, it's X number of generations. But let's just say, to be on the conservative side, it's about 10 generations. Although the mathematician said 7. But okay, if that's the case, if it started in the Neolithic age, let's just say it started with the 3000 BC with the Egyptians building the pyramids or whatever. By 2000 BC, everybody would be an abductee. See what I mean? It would have happened. And if it started in the year 1100, by 1200, everybody would be an abductee, or maybe 1300. And if it started, you see what I mean, it started in the 15th century, by the 17th century, everybody would be an abductee. And we know that that is not the case in the United States and in the world. And we can surmise from our various studies and our surveys and this and that, that probably somewhere between 2 and 5% of the people, maybe 2 and 6% of the people, are abductees. Now, if you work back at 2 and 6% and you work backward into their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents and family stories as well about that came down through the ages about, for example, here's one where a guy was in on his own land and he went into a cave and he saw something strange and something scared the hell out of him and he ran through his field and suddenly he quote, fainted, and when he woke up from his, quote, faint, there was a giant bunny rabbit staring him in his eye, a 6 foot or 5 foot bunny rabbit staring him in his eyes. That would be a story that's an actual story that came down in an abductee family. Now, when you go back to 6 or 5% of the people and you work backwards, you get the starting point of the phenomenon in the late 19th century, maybe late 1980s, 1880s rather, or 1890s, maybe commensurate with the mystery airship wave of 1896, 1897, but around that time. And after that, we really totally lose sight of it. And we don't see it much in any kind of literature we don't see it by scientists writing about it. We don't see it just disappears for all intents and purposes. So that's one way of dating it anyway. It's just a guess. It's not really scientific, but it's an educated guess, and I think it's a good guess. It makes a lot of sense for a lot of things that way.
Now, the people you've dealt with that you've said you sometimes stay in touch with for years, is it usually just a one-off experience, or are people repeatedly abducted?
No, people are abducted over and over and over again with great frequency from the time that they are infants until the time that they are into old age. Now, we know it stops somewhere in old age because people don't report 100-year-olds walking around on board a UFO. So we know that it's got to stop somewhere, and we think. Most people will see people who are in their 50s, 60s, and then a serious drop-off in 70s and 80s. It might just because that cone-like effect is there, and there just aren't that many people who are abducted who are now in their 80s. You see what I mean?
And when the people are being repeatedly abducted, are they being put through the same kind of invasive procedures again, or does that sort of lessen?
The question you're asking, if I may rephrase it, is do we see change over time?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, yes and yes. They are put through the same procedures. But in order to backtrack on that just a little bit, to fill in here, what we had assumed when we first started to look at this subject in the late 70s, early 80s, for all intents and purposes, the general accepted model of an abduction was that this was an experiment, that this was a study, that, in fact, these beings were trying to learn something about us just as if we would visit another planet and we would do the same thing. We would grab them, we would run experiments on them, we might pull their legs off, see what's inside, whatever it is that we do, you know what I mean? And that seems to be reinforced by the Barney and Betty Hill case, which was, of course, the most famous UFO case, abduction case of its time, which took place in 1961, where Barney and Betty Hill said they were placed on a table, and this was done to them, that was done to them. There was a certain amount of reproductive interest in them, and they took a sperm sample from Barney, and they were interested in Betty's reproductive system. So we thought, yes, well, that makes sense. There's logic to that. And we held on to this model for a long, long time. Over the years, in my own research and in others' research, that model just didn't hold. The evidence just wasn't there for it. We wanted the evidence to be there because that made sense. What else could they possibly be interested in? What else could they possibly be doing? But it didn't hold. In other words, the information wasn't there. I'm not going to say science because this is all anecdotal, but the anecdotes weren't there. Yes, they were taking people and they were, you know, running their reproductive, physical, and mental procedures on them. But once they got them on a table and took eggs and took sperm and did this and did that or whatever it was they did, it usually was not the reason for the abduction. There was usually something else involved. And Hopkins discovered in the early 80s that people were shown strange-looking babies that looked like a combination between human and alien. I remember when he called me up once, he said, David, he said, I found the most amazing case. I looked at the most amazing case, I ever heard in my life. He said, this woman told her, it was taken into the room, and they told her to take this baby, which looked like a weird baby, you know, and hold the baby. And I listened to him tell me this. I thought, what in the hell is he saying? What do you mean, baby? What do you mean? How can you use the word baby and flying saucer in the same sentence? You know what I mean? It didn't make any sense to me at all. And he said, it's more than that. He said they had her put the baby to her breast and feed the baby. And I said, feed the baby? What are you talking about? That's not possible. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, did she tell them that there has to be a certain series of physical processes that take place in the human body for a woman to be able to lactate, to feed the baby? And this is a woman who's not been married and who didn't have a child or anything? He said, yes. He told her that. She told him that, but they had her put the baby to her breast anyway. And I thought to myself, if this is true, if this is happening, this is before I started even doing research myself, hypnosis myself, then this has got to be sort of the end point where our logical brains stop and the aliens' brains start, because their style of thinking sort of features form over content. The form is put the baby to your breast. The content is there's no milk. Well, of course, that was totally completely untrue. It just was ignorance on our part. Subsequently, we learned that there's a series of specific procedures that can be readily identified that, in fact, will cause lactation, and women, in fact, are lactating, whether they know it or not. And when they say feed the baby, it's perfectly logical. The baby is fed. So there are those kinds of procedures. And then people see these sort of little children. Hopkins called them hybrid children. And they're little babies. They see them as toddlers. They see them as young kids. They see them as older kids, 11, 12 years old. They see them as adolescents. They see them as young adults. They see them as adults. And then they don't see them as older adults for reasons that we do not know. And these hybrids have had an increasingly complex role in the abduction phenomenon over the years. And that is something that has been rather remarkable for us and a little bit disturbing too. And so over the years, and this abductees would not know this, of course, when they're telling this to me, what they are telling is that we used to see hybrids who are older in specific roles, that is to say, as helpers, helping take people up on board the object, helping do this, helping do that. Then we would see them performing actual procedures on abductees and with aliens around supervising and so forth. Then we began to see more hybrids doing procedures, less aliens. And then eventually we saw abduction events being done completely by hybrids with no aliens in evidence. Now, that's not true for everyone, but we would see this from time to time. So you get this increasing importance of the world of hybrids. And in the past 10 years, all I've done is just study primarily hybrids. That's been my sort of major interest these days.
You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio 96.5 LPFM, and we're also streaming live at WSLR.org. We're just going to take a short music break, and then I'll be back talking to Dr. David Jacobs about his research into the alien abduction phenomenon. For more information on Dr. Jacobs and his work, you can go to the ICAR website, which is ufoabduction.com. And we'll be back in a few moments. Welcome back. You just heard Roger Taylor with Future Management. You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio. My name is Emily, and I'm talking to Dr. David Jacobs, a UFO researcher for over 40 years and the director of the International Center for Abduction Research. Dr. Jacobs, before the break, you were talking about the hybrid aliens. What part or what role do you think that plays in the whole alien abduction thing? I mean, is it like a thing where you think they might be trying to come on Earth and intermingle with us?
Well, of course, this is not something that you have to remember that the material that I'm talking about now here is not something that I ever wanted to hear. It's not something that I thrust into people's minds. In fact, I actually tried to unthrust it from people's minds. But the abduction phenomenon is what it is. It has its own life, its own integrity. It's unrelated to people's lives. It's unrelated to their upbringing. It's unrelated to their educational level, geographic area, intellectual level, political, economic, religious, or any other aspect of their lives. This is a global phenomenon. It is not an American phenomenon, and it is not something that that is a product of popular culture. It's not something that's a product of sleep paralysis or of the 28 other written explanations for the abduction phenomenon, all of which do not take into account the evidence as we know it. So what I'm going to say then is going to be directly from what abductees say. I'm not going to be interpreting this. I'm not going to be saying anything that people have not told me. In other words, you're not getting my story here. From time to time, people would tell me that now, when you're on board the object, you're passive. In other words, you can't thrash about, run, pick up something and whack somebody over the head with it. You can't do anything like that. You're just glassy-eyed, arms outside, shuffling along through the hallways, as they take you from here to here to here to here. And from time to time, abductees would say they take me into a room, and there might be some other abductees in the room. And their attention is directed to a screen-like device on the wall. They take a look at the screen-like device, and suddenly there's a sort of moving picture of a picnic. This would be a standard American picnic. There's a table, there's a grill, people are playing ball, people are talking to each other, it's in a park. It's just an absolutely normal scene. And they say, and they'll be looking at this, wondering, why am I seeing this, you know. And then they'll hear telepathically, that is to say, in their mind's ear, so to speak, can you tell the difference between you and us? And they'll look at the motion picture there or whatever it is, and they'll wonder, why is he even asking me this question? Of course there's no difference. It's just a group of humans, just a group of people having a picnic. And they'll say, no, everybody looks the same here. You know, what's this all about or whatever? And they'll say, see, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that great? Soon we will all be together. Soon we will all be happy. Soon we will be together, basically down there, you know, on Earth or whatever. And now, when you hear that once, you just put it on the back burner, waiting for confirmation from other people. Well, then I began to get confirmation. You know, one person is There's a photograph, let's just say, their attention is directed, and it looks like a photograph. There's a bunch of people standing as if they were posing for a picture, and it's like a high school picture where people are standing on steps, you know what I mean? And they'll hear in their minds, can you pick out us from this group? And the person looks at it and says, no, I can't do that. Everybody looks the same. And they'll hear the same thing. See, isn't this wonderful? Isn't this great? Soon we will all be together. then I began to hear a whole series of these other sort of, we're going to have a great change, soon there's going to be a great change, soon we'll be together, soon everybody will know his place. That's an actual sentence from one person anyway. And I began to get more and more of these, and I began to realize that, well, maybe there's something there. Maybe soon they will be here. Now the question then is, what do you mean by soon? How can we interpret that word? And they didn't know. People just didn't know. I don't know. They just said the word soon. That's all they know is soon. Now, is soon a million years? Is it 30 years? Is it tomorrow? It's a word that can't be really defined very well. So when I wrote my third book, which is actually my second book on the abduction phenomenon called The Threat, I said, well, I don't know what 30 years mean. I mean, what the word soon means, but I assume it's probably maybe within the next 30 years, as one person had suggested. Well, I think that's probably right, because since 2003, I've been hearing accounts of abductees being enlisted, against their will, of course, to help young hybrids move into various places, apartments or whatever, and teach young hybrids who are doing this how to live here. That is to say, go to a 7-Eleven at night, buy something, teach them that they have to have money, teach them they have to go up to the counter, teach them that they have to give the money to the person behind the register, teach them to wait there, teach them to then receive the change, teach them to say thank you.
Are these what people have named indigo children?
No, these are hybrids. These are adult hybrids. Well, actually, they're young adults who look quite human. They were not born here. They don't have parents. They have not been subjected to family life. They have not lived in a home. They are created on board the objects, and they have lived up there until I started hearing these reports. Now, maybe these reports are wrong, and maybe people are fantasizing it. I don't know. I still need to do more research. This is change over time. This is change over time. And everything sort of leads in this direction. In other words, when people describe what happens to them, they find themselves in teaching positions where they have to teach a whole group of maybe 10 or 15 hybrid children, maybe they're age 6 or 7, about what life on Earth is like. What is a dog? What is a goat? What is a horse? What is a cow? Things like that. They teach them about what it's like to be in school. They teach them about how human children have mothers and fathers and families, and how different that is than up here, you know. And I just get story after story. In other words, you have to think about it this way. If this were just completely based on internal generation, psychologically generated, for whatever reason, whether it's brain disorders or popular culture or whatever reason, if it comes out of a person's brain, it's going to be idiosyncratic. It's going to be based on that person's life. It's going to be based on that person's upbringing. It's going to, if the kid was kept in a closet for the first 9 years of his life, that might show up, you know, in how they relate these stories. That is not the case. That is not what we find. What we find is that everybody is completely different, and all the stories are exactly the same.
So the people who are in contact with or have experienced contact with these hybrids, do they say what they're like? I mean, how are they literally just sort of very robotic people? Or?
No. I don't know. You know, when I talked about hybrids, there's been sort of a long evolutional thought about these hybrid babies and hybrid children and hybrid adults and all that. But these are ones that have been created to look quite human. We know a little bit about the creation process. We know a little bit how that happens. But these are just regular humans. Now here's, I'm going to backtrack. and tell you what the problem is. The problem here is that when people are abducted, they are, let's just say they're sitting on their couch and they're watching Jay Leno. They got their hand on a book, their left hand on a book, their right hand on a can of beer, whatever it is, and they're just sitting there watching and they're thinking, you know, right after Leno comes Conan O'Brien, and I really want to see Conan O'Brien. I'm waiting to see Conan O'Brien because I love Conan O'Brien. And the next thing you know, Conan O'Brien is over, and some other show is on. And there is no, and they think to themselves, what the heck happened? How did this happen? And there's this sort of abduction event. But what really happened was when you do hypnosis with them, while they were sitting there, then they knew something was wrong and somebody was coming into the room, maybe through the window or not, or maybe through the wall, and they couldn't move, and they suddenly found themselves floating up, and they put their beer down on their book or whatever it was, and they floated up through the closed window. They're taken out, and all these sort of experiences happen to them, and the point is that they couldn't get up and run. They couldn't turn around, grab the phone, dial 911. They couldn't reach beneath the pillows of the couch and get out their Magnum 44 and blow somebody's head off. They couldn't do anything like that. They just sat there while it happened, and then they were taken out. That means that they were neurologically controlled, and they were controlled from a distance. Now, what that distance is, whether it's a trillion miles away or 20 feet, we don't really know. I have my sense it's in the foot or yard range, but they are controlled. When they're on board the object, they're in total control by the aliens. They walk around, they'll walk through a hallway and they'll see a couple of aliens bringing another abductee towards them and to pass them by in the hallway, and they'll say to themselves, gee, that guy looks like a zombie. And we know that that guy is looking at this woman, let's just say, who's saying that, thinking to himself, God, she looks like a zombie. they have no facial expression to speak of. They're in control. They can walk. They can't run. They can move their arms. They can't flail. And not only that, but there's other things, too. All communication is telepathic. So they can... They know that they have to get their clothes off. They know they have to get up on a table. They know that they have to now leave. They know this. They know that. And there's no sound in these rooms other than people shuffling around and the clanking of instruments and that sort of stuff. All communication is telepathic. It's a completely telepathic society. Not only that, but I discovered early on that people say that they're being looked at. And I said, well, I would assume you're being looked at. I mean, you know, you're on board and you're sort of theirs and all that. No, they're looking at me real closely. And I say, well, where are they looking? Well, they're looking at my face. Well, where are they looking? Looking at your chin, you mean, or your ears? Or no, they're looking in my eyes. I say, well, how close are they? Oh, his forehead is touching mine. I say, well, can you look away? Avert your attention? No. Can you close your eyes? No. Then I ask the question, well, if they're staring into your eyes, what's going on in your mind? Well, that opened up a whole other neurological world of, I won't go into it now, but a complex neurological world of them basically hooking into the optic nerve from what we can gather, using it as a conduit to hook into other neural sites within the brain, and then they can stimulate memories from the last week, they can stimulate emotions if they want, they can do all sorts of different things. But the problem here is that there's a gap between the two eyes. So how they can do that is beyond my ability to understand. However, I will say this, Emily. Every single abductee that I have worked with, I've had more than one session with in the past 22 years or however long it's been, talks about this procedure. It is part of the abduction phenomenon. All abductees go through it.
So they have their mind sucked out a little bit, or memories or pictures sucked out by the alien.
There's a neurological engagement which allows them to see things, that allows the beings to look at their minds. Who knows? There's a variety of things you can do. Here's why I'm telling you this. The hybrids can do that too. Not with the strength that aliens do, but they can do it anyway. That means that the hybrids who are busy moving in and learning how to buy something at 7-Eleven can, in fact, control the environment and the people just neurologically. That makes them a different species, regardless of how they look, than we are. And that makes us sort of second class and them first class, because we cannot do that to them. And that scares me, I got to admit. You know, that's disconcerting. That gives me pause. That's the main difference. They look completely human, but that's the difference. That is the main difference. It's the critical difference. It's the bone-crushing difference, unfortunately.
Well, the very new agey way of looking at it would be to say that they're here for our benefit and to, you know, bring us up to more a level of enlightenment, and it's a good thing they're here. So you're looking at it from more of a, that they are not quite so benign.
There's no evidence whatsoever that either I or my colleague Bud Hopkins have ever found to suggest that they're here for our benevolence. There's tons of evidence to suggest they're here for their own agenda. Period. They're here because they want to be here. You have to understand that when you take a look at the UFO phenomenon, it is a global phenomenon. And when you're looking at UFOs, you're just looking at a tiny little tip of the iceberg. With UFOs abducting people, and my sense is that the UFOs are here basically to abduct people, but you've got to have people somewhere behind the scenes, beings. Somebody's got to say, let's do it. We're going to do it here. We're going to do the abduction thing here. You have to have research and design so that you design tables and instruments specifically for the human species. Those have to be presented. They have to be looked at. They have to be manufactured, if not rejected first and then redesigned. There's got to be trial periods. There has to be a certain amount of to and fro in terms of restocking items, that is to say, supplies and all the rest of that stuff. There's got to be massive coordination on a global scale. We see on board these objects a hierarchy of labor from top down. Everybody knows their place. They all have certain functions. What I'm saying here is that this is a global phenomenon. It is massive, and it is exceptionally important. And when it comes to people, there's no indication, and I wish I could say the difference, I wish I wasn't saying this, that this is going to be good for us. It will be good for them. That they are all agreed upon in terms of the, when they describe the future, it's going to be wonderful, it's going to be great, it's going to be wonderful for them. Their society, from what I've seen, is not a society that we would want to live in. Theirs is a telepathic society that bases, that has, telepathy is not just old way they can communicate with their minds. It's much, much more than that. It is a whole different way of acting and looking and thinking. It's a deprivatization of the individual. It's a corporate, almost hive-like society. There's also a fairly narrow range of emotions within alien society. You don't see any aesthetic effects anywhere on board a UFO. There's no drawings and paintings or anything like that, or design elements that make it look nice. Because it's a telepathic society, there's no music. There's no poetry. There's no. The ripple effect of telepathy is just almost unfathomably vast.
Well, hopefully, though, what we've seen so far, because I would imagine it would be the same as if they're a military body, just as we have military organizations on Earth, and they tend to be rather robotic and, you know, they have the hierarchical system. So I would hope that wherever these aliens come from, their actual societies are slightly different than, you know, we would find just going in a spaceship.
Yeah, it might be a lot worse, for all we know. We just don't know, because the societies that, see, hybrids don't live in those societies. It's just the straight aliens that do, and aliens, the gray aliens and the taller insect-like ones and all that, they live in a much more alien society than the hybrids do. The hybrids have a sense of, there's a certain sense of humanity about them. Not in terms of humanity in terms of generosity, but humanity in terms of being human. They complain, they do this, they do that. The younger ones, the adolescents, act very human in many ways.
Perhaps that's the desired effect, to be able to experience our emotions?
No. It's just that they're becoming human. I think what hybrids are, they're just surrogates to come here and integrate into the society, and ultimately the loyalties are to the aliens. I don't know exactly why. I don't think that aliens can live here, to tell you the truth. I don't think that this is a proper environment for them. But when you look human, you're much more acceptable. Now, I have to say that everything that I am telling you right now came out of left field. It was nothing that I expected. And I would tell people now, I don't want you to tell me anything bad. I just want to hear good things. Don't tell me anything bad in this session. Don't tell me anything bad. Then I would do a session to see how that would work. It's a direct command, you know, from me. And the people didn't care less. Could care less what I said. All they remember is what happened to them. You know, what I said didn't mean anything to them. You know, or I'd say things like, this sounds like a dream. This couldn't be true. This is just a dream. This is a dream.
Dr. Jacobs, it's been wonderful talking to you. And I hope that we can talk again soon, because I think you obviously have a lot of stuff to talk about. We could do several shows on this. Unfortunately, we've run out of time.
It went fast. Thank you, Emily.
It really did. And I'd just like to say you've been listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio. My name is Emily, and I've been talking to Dr. David Jacobs about his research into the alien abduction phenomenon. For more information on Dr. Jacobs and his work, you can go to the website, which is ufoabduction.com. So, Dr. Jacobs, thank you so much. Do you have any plans to write any new books in the near future?
Well, I do have a book in the back of my brain. I've been trying to get somebody to publish it, but I think it's just too crazy to publish, to tell you the truth.
Well, I'm sure people are ready for it. What's going to be the topic?
Well, it'll be about hybrids. It'll be about the hybrid world and integrating hybrids into the society and the processes and the bureaucracy involved with integrating hybrids. It's much more complex than you would have imagined.
Well, I hope it's not just on the back burner. I hope it's something that's in motion. And I'd certainly love to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.